Thanks for joining us for Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase. It's our performing arts program devoted to Iowa's not-for-profit arts and cultural organizations. I'm Jacqueline Hallblum. In our December edition of the Iowa Arts Showcase, we'll explore three holiday concert opportunities, plus look ahead to a couple of exceptional January offerings. We'll stop by the Hoyt Sherman Place in Des Moines to learn the inside scoop about the Des Moines Metro Opera's presentation of Menotti's Amahl and the Night Visitors. We'll drop by the Westminster Presbyterian Church in Des Moines to hear about their full staging of the First Noel. We'll learn how one of Iowa's most famous humanitarians, educators, and philanthropists has planned an amazing concert of over 1,000 at ISU's Hilton Coliseum. And we'll delve into two stunning January opera concerts in Des Moines and Cedar Rapids. That's all ahead on Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase.
Well, this is such a special show, and it's a special opportunity, I think, for audiences to hear and to see this work performed by extraordinary professional singers. We've assembled an extraordinary professional cast that will perform this work extraordinarily well with a beautiful set and amazing lighting design and costumes and a professional chorus and dancers and that sort of thing. It won't be very often that you'll get a chance to really see this performance, this production, done up the way we're going to do it on December 7th. And I hope that people will take advantage of the opportunity to see this done very, very well.
Michael Eagle, Artistic Director of the Des Moines Metro Opera. Michael was speaking about the Des Moines Metro Opera's marvelous holiday productions of Menotti's Amahl and the Night Visitors. Two performances remain this afternoon at 2 and again tonight at 7:30 at the Hoyt Sherman Place in Des Moines. Menotti waited for inspiration before he composed his most famous opera.
It was the first opera in America commissioned to be performed for the first time on television. Executives at the NBC studios commissioned Italian-American composer Giancarlo Menotti to write a one-hour piece for television for the holiday season. Menotti, by that time, had already become established as an important composer of operas that had been premiered on Broadway, and was a really celebrated and slightly controversial musical figure in the 1950s. I love reading the story of Menotti's genesis of this opera, where he had received the commission but had really spent a very long time trying to find the right subject matter for this tale. And it wasn't until really the 11th hour, when he was strolling the halls of the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City, looking for inspiration, struggling to find that right tale to set to music, when he happened upon a famous painting by Hieronymus Bosch called The Adoration of the Magi, which depicts the three wise men having arrived at the scene of the Nativity with the Virgin Mary and the Christ child. And he imagined a stop along their long and incredible journey following the Star of David at a stop of a house along the way of a mother and her crippled son Amahl, and what might have happened as they begged for a shelter for the night along their journey.
Menotti had sort of a different take. He often would make things into his own and bring things into it. And in fact, he wrote the libretto for this, did he not?
That's right. And he was very famous, one of the few composers in the history of opera that wrote both their own words and their own music for most of his compositional output. That is not something that is very common. So it's such a beautiful marriage of text and music, perfectly capturing, I think, a child's wonderment at all of the things that surround the holiday season. To me, it just seems so natural and such a part of the holiday season that it seems to me to have always been a part of the Christmas story. And when I think back to the fact that it's really only about 60 years old, it's quite incredible to me.
Tell us briefly a bit about Menotti's life, and he was a child prodigy.
what's true. And I think Menotti tends to be dismissed in a certain sense, elite circles of musicologists and music historians these days. His music was probably considered overly sentimental and overly melodic when he was writing at a time when other types of more dissonant music were popular. But in retrospect, now he died in 2007, and I think we can look back at a pretty vast compositional output that includes some of the most important American operas that have ever been written. I think of The Consul and The Medium, and of course, Amahl and the Night Visitors, which it may be interesting to note, ranks as the most often performed opera in the entire world of all composers and of all types of music and in all centuries. I think that's a remarkable achievement for an American composer.
And following World War II, television was a really new thing, and to have an opera and one commissioned to be on television was kind of a big deal.
That's true, and it was broadcast, I think, for several consecutive years at the holiday season on NBC. I'm very pleased that just recently they've elected to release one of the earliest performances on DVD. And the young man that sings the role of Amahl is a gentleman by the name of Bill McIver. And I only recently found out that Bill McIver is the father of Des Moines' own Matthew McIver, who is one of the founding members of the Des Moines Social Club and somebody whom maybe many of your Des Moines area listeners know. I've spent some time with Matt McIver talking about his dad's recollections of being one of the first boy sopranos to sing this pivotal title role. And here we have our very own Iowa connection to that, one of those early performances. I think that's very interesting.
Well, tell us about your production, and then you're bringing back some Des Moines Metro Opera favorites.
That's right. This is a special production for many, many reasons. This is a production that we are pleased to be doing outside of our regular summer performing season, and it is being performed in celebration of the life of Wendy Waugaman Carlson, who was a president of the board of Des Moines Metro Operas, an ardent friend of the company, and a good friend of mine. She passed away a couple of years ago. She was always very passionate about our company performing outside of the time period and the constraints of our summer festival season. So we are launching this year our second Stages series, which will feature performances in addition to our summer festival season in creative spaces. This, I'm very happy to say, is the first of that series, and it's in honor of Wendy Waugaman, so we're very, very pleased to be able to do this to celebrate her life. These performances will feature a beautiful set and a beautiful setting. Some of your listeners may know that the Hoyt Sherman Place is decorated so beautifully at the holiday season, and so folks who come to the performances will have a chance to take in that historic facility at a very beautiful time of the year. And I'm pleased to say that this production will also feature the return of our founder, Robert Larson, who will be providing the stage direction for this production. This was the first piece that he ever directed many years ago, and so it's one that holds a special place in his heart. And when we decided to do it in honor of Wendy, why he couldn't resist coming back out of retirement to direct this for us, so we're thrilled about that. Of course, it will be conducted by David Neely, our principal conductor. And we have a fantastic cast. Julie Makarov will sing the role of the mother. She was an audience favorite last season as Chrysothemis in Electra, an incredible singer, an incredible actress with a very powerful voice, who comes to us actually having just had her own child. She, in between singing Electra last summer and coming to us for this performance, she's given birth to her own son, Liam, who will be with her for this performance. And the Three Kings will be played by Todd Thomas, who is an audience favorite. Many people know and love Todd for many performances throughout the years at Des Moines Metro Opera. Ed Griffith, who is a fantastic local talent, a local tenor, who's done many, many things with Des Moines Metro Opera and many performances around the area and around the region. I'm thrilled to have him with us for the role of King Caspar. And Patrick Blackwell returns to sing the role of Balthazar. And in the title role, this is a very difficult role to cast because you're looking for a young man with an unchanged voice. We have Merrill Middle School sixth grader Pierce Mansfield, who will be singing the role of Amahl for the first time.
They have said about A Mall in the Night Visitors that it was Menotti's need to reconcile simple faith with the ambiguities of religion. What do you think they meant by that?
You know, for me, Menotti invented this scenario of having stopped for shelter for the night at the poor, humble cottage of this mother and this boy, Amal. And the events that happen in this short piece are so profound and yet so simple that it seems like they've always been a part of the lore of the Christmas story, and yet it's a scenario that's completely fabricated and told with the awe and wisdom and yet simplicity of how a child might view events at the holiday season. It's so profound and so moving and yet so utterly simple and endearing that it's childlike in its wisdom, I think.
Are there any particular arias or moments in this opera that you would like to point out or that are your favorites?
Every moment is so beautiful and so perfectly done. We start with a scene between Amal and his mother as they're getting prepared for bed that evening, and the kings arrive. There's a glorious procession as the kings are welcomed into the house, a fantastic quartet between the three kings and the mother while Amal is out gathering the shepherds, discussing the contrast between the mother's struggle for day-to-day survival on very little means and the king's very lofty hope for what the arrival of this child might mean for the world. A beautiful chorus of shepherds and shepherdesses as they come and offer the fruits of their harvest to the kings and in homage to the kings. The mother sings a glorious aria about, after everyone has gone to sleep, as she lays awake looking at the gold that the kings are bringing and the treasures that the kings are bringing to lay at the feet of the child, and thinking about what it is that she might be able to do for her own child with just a tiny bit of that gold. And then a beautiful aria that King Melchior sings, and I don't want to give away the plot point of the climax of the opera, but about what the child will mean for the world. And then, of course, one of the final scenes when Amal makes his great sacrifice to the child, and the Christmas miracle, the holiday miracle, happens on stage in front of our very eyes.
Michael Eagle, executive director of the Des Moines Metro Opera. It's still not too late to attend the Des Moines Metro Opera's last two A Mall in the Night Visitors performances, this afternoon at 2 or tonight at 7:30 at the Hoyt Sherman in Des Moines. For tickets, please call the Hoyt Sherman box office at 515-244-0507, extension 213, or you can purchase your tickets at the door at the Hoyt Sherman prior to today's performances. Tomorrow, St. Mark's Lutheran Church in Marion will be hosting their Christmas Faith Concert at 3 p.m. with St. Mark's organist Barbara Ritchie performing on their newly refurbished Skinner organ. Just ahead on the Iowa Arts Showcase, you'll hear about the fully staged production of The First Noel by Vaughan Williams. We'll learn details about the Iowa Students Care Christmas Concert being held next weekend. And we'll find out about two special opera offerings coming to Iowa in January. You're listening to the Iowa Arts Showcase on Iowa Public Radio.
What I love about Vaughan Williams' music is he was an agnostic by profession, but wrote some of the most wonderfully introspective and beautiful church music that England produced in the 20th century. And the piece starts off in mystery. It's neither an E minor nor G major, but a combination of the two, and it kind of oscillates back and forth and finally starts in E minor. And he pulls that material back at the very end. I mean, the first Noel rings in our ears with this wonderful D major, and it's bright and it's glorious, and the congregation is singing along with the choir and the soloists and the kids and the orchestra at its fullest effect. And then, rather than just end there, the option is given to kind of work its way back down in the same kind of descending, mysterious way that the piece starts. And instead of ending in a minor key like we began, it ends with this major key. And I think that's one of the clues and one of the wonderful things about Vaughan Williams is that he always was searching. He was always questioning. He was always asking. But at the end of the day, he was hopeful. I think you find that in a lot of his music. And there's this wonderful awe about things. I really think that's why people are drawn to it. At least I know that's why I'm drawn to it.
My response to it seems sort of pedestrian since I'm not the musicologist. But what I think that this piece offers, and in some ways it's surprising that it's not performed more often in the fully staged version, but I think that there's a universal feeling about the whole production, a way that it can really reach people and remind them about what the spirit of Christmas is all about, regardless of your own personal beliefs, mm-hmm. that reminds me of what is a tradition for so many people, and that is to see either a full production of the Christmas Carol, to see a fully danced and orchestrated version of the Nutcracker at the holidays. I think that this really has a way to reach people at a level that goes well more than skin deep and to refresh them. It combines the familiar with not just the story, but by the use of many of these familiar tunes and carols, and yet set in such an elaborate and beautiful setting in such a way that it really sort of elevates it to a higher level. And so to me, it's the fact that it can take an average audience member who doesn't necessarily need to know the history or necessarily understand the progression of keys and that kind of thing, and reach out and really touch them and remind them of what the holiday season is really all about.
The Westminster Presbyterian Church Minister of Music and Fine Arts in Des Moines, John Cook, and the founder and director of the Integral Artist Theater, Ron Gilbert, talking about their collaboration on the Nativity play, The First Noel, by Vaughan Williams. This is the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jacqueline Hallbloom. John talks about the work's history.
Simona Pankingham was an English author and wrote a book, I believe in 1955, towards the end of Vaughan Williams' life, about her love for Vaughan Williams' music. They had never met at this point. And she wrote a book just kind of as a glowing love letter to people to listen to his music, to enjoy it. A copy found its way to him, and several people said, you really should meet this lovely young lady. And they met for tea, actually, and became friends for 3 years until Vaughan Williams passed away in 58. She would go on and was writing on and working on another project, a medieval nativity play that she was writing for St. Martin's in the Fields for a refugee fund for Christmas, and approached Vaughan Williams about doing the music for the play. And he just loved the idea and ended up becoming one of the last pieces that he wrote.
Then how did this piece finally get finished?
Well, he passed away in August of 58, rather unexpectedly. He was 86 years old, and he was working with his musical assistant, a wonderful accompanist by the name of Roy Douglas. Roy actually, by the way, is still alive. He is 106 years old this year and is kicking around England somewhere. And they really just did not like the thought of leaving St. Martin's in the Field hanging for Christmas. And so Roy looked over what sketches that were done, and he felt like about three quarters of it were done and the rest of it was pretty well sketched out. And so he took a run at it. He had been working with Vaughan Williams for about 10, 15 years, working on different things, orchestrations, and Vaughan Williams had notoriously awful handwriting and nobody could read it, but for some reason it worked and Roy could. And so he took the sketches and he was able to finish the music and present it to St. Martin's in the Field for their Christmas pageant that year.
John goes on to talk about the work.
It's one of those pieces where it just kind of fell by the wayside. It gets overshadowed, I think, a lot by the fantasy on Christmas carols that Vaughan Williams wrote when he was much younger, and the Hodier, which is just a wonderful but enormous Christmas work. This one just never really kind of found its home, and it's a wonderful piece.
Well, this is quite an honor for you to be presenting this because you received a special grant. Tell us about this connection.
I was doing research for the piece and looking around for partners to help put it together, and I found the Ralph Vaughan Williams Charitable Trust online, and they have a trust established to produce obscure works of Vaughan Williams, mostly the operas, but this piece was appealing to them because it's such a wonderful thing and no one really does it, especially the version we're doing, which is the full version, which involves actors and staging. So there's a smaller concert version that's done from time to time, but we're really fortunate in that we received a grant from them to put the full thing on.
Ron and John continue talking about their collaboration.
This partnership with John came as really sort of a nice complement to other projects that I had been doing with various different theater companies here in Des Moines. And I'm just really excited about the opportunity to combine the dramatic stuff that you're used to seeing on stage, but with such a beautiful musical choral work with the symphony and the choir behind it. I think that this is such a unique combination. And while the history is great and goes all the way back to medieval plays, to be able to actually see that stage now, where you're combining that full chorus and the orchestra along with actors telling the story, just makes a kind of a combination of artistry that you don't often see performed live.
Tell us about the plot and then who and what and everyone that's going to be involved, because you have quite a cast with an orchestra and choirs and all sorts of things.
The story is actually quite simple. It begins with the Annunciation of the birth of Christ to the Virgin Mary and goes all the way through the birth, the travel to Bethlehem, the visit of the three wise men, and finishes with the title piece, The First Noel. It's rather interesting in that it's medieval tellings of these story. And in fact, Pankingham writes in her notes, no attempt to be biblically accurate should be attempted. This is strictly something that happened in her mind and in the stories of the people from which she drew the plays. This is something that happened kind of outside biblical tradition. And so it's just kind of another take on the story that, you know, at least in the church circles, and we know pretty well. So,
and the story is really crafted in a way that makes it so audience friendly. They've been able to take the story that we're so familiar with, but give it a very human touch. We have a chance to see that when the announcement of this virgin pregnancy is happening, that Joseph is not necessarily all in favor of that from the beginning. And there's characters of three shepherds that sort of play a comic relief role that's very similar to the gravediggers in the play Hamlet. And so you get a telling of this story that isn't just sort of stuffed shirt formal that we're used to seeing. It really makes it a very human kind of story that I think really draws the audience in.
I agree.
Who are some of your soloists and musicians and actors that will be performing in this presentation?
Well, we're really fortunate that we have a very, very talented core in our congregation of musicians and singers, and a third of our orchestra will be drawn from our congregation, who are band teachers and professionals throughout the Des Moines community. And then we also have a really great relationship with the Des Moines Symphony too, and we will pull our concertmaster John Helmick, who plays with them, and several different musicians who would be joining us from around the central Iowa area. The choir actually will be the members of Westminster Presbyterian. We have about 40 members in our chancel choir, about 30 members in our youth chorale, that's our 6th graders through our 12th graders, and then about 30 to 35 2nd through 5th graders. So we'll have just over 100 singers on stage, in addition to the two soloists who are good friends of the series, Aaron Davis and Rippy, who actually is a homegrown Westminster from baptism all the way up, and then a good friend of ours by the name of Clay Hulsey, who is a freelancer here in Des Moines and has got a wonderful baritone voice, and will be providing vocal commentary from the choir.
And on the acting side, I'm fortunate that I have quite a bit of experience working in the Des Moines theater community with most of the companies that perform here, as well as with some of the local colleges. And so we're still putting the finishing touches on the acting crew. John has had an advantage with the music rehearsal starting early, but we're going to put together a group of actors that will really kind of represent people working in the theater here and that will make a really solid contribution to this.
Vaughn Williams uses a lot of carols in this first Noel. Tell us about some of the famous works that people will be hearing.
Vaughn Williams was one of the patriarchs of English song. The play begins with God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen. It's very much a piece that is an older version of his Fantasy on Christmas Carols, a much more mature version. He's kind of looking back. From God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen, we move into This Is the Truth Sent From Above, which has been heard in his Christmas music earlier. He uses several versions of the Cherry Tree Carol to kind of comment on what Ron was saying earlier about Joseph's kind of righteous indignation about the whole situation he's in. And it's this wonderful little metaphor of Joseph becoming annoyed and angry and frustrated and then having this conversion moment, and then ultimately reconciling with Mary at the end of these three versions of the Cherry Tree Carol. The one I'm actually looking forward to the most is the only non-Anglican piece in the entire work, and that's The Entrance of the Three Kings, which is a march-style setting of How Brightly Shone the Morning Star, which is actually a Lutheran tune. It's set in a very, very Bach style, which Vaughn Williams was a great fan of Johann Sebastian Bach, and it's this wonderful kind of just joyous march of these three kings. This wonderful image of them kind of coming over the horizon and all of their retinue and all the camels and various sundry people that they would be bringing with them, and hope and joy is just kind of just fills the piece. And then finally, you know, it wouldn't be the first Noel if we didn't sing the first Noel. And so the closing piece actually starts off very, very quietly and mysteriously in the same way that the piece starts. And it just kind of builds and builds as the first Noel kind of becomes the summation moment of the whole work.
The Westminster Presbyterian Church Minister of Music and Fine Arts in Des Moines, John Cook, and the founder and director of Integral Artist Theater, Ron Gilbert, talking about their production of the Nativity play, The First Noel by Vaughn Williams. Westminster Presbyterian Church in Des Moines will be presenting The First Noel twice on Sunday morning, December 15th at 8:45 and 11. For more details, please see their website, westpres.org, and click on the Arts and Music link. Don't go away. We'll learn about an amazing holiday concert supporting a good cause, featuring over 1,200 singers and instrumentalists. And we'll hear about a guest opera recital and opera performances of Carmen coming to Iowa in January. You're listening to the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio. Next weekend, the Simon Estes Foundation is presenting Simon Estes and the Iowa Students Care Choir under ISU's Dr. James Rohde and the Des Moines Symphony Youth Orchestra under Maestro Joseph Junta in a special concert on Sunday afternoon, December 15th at 3 at the Hilton Coliseum in Ames. The Iowa Students Care Christmas Concert will bring awareness and raise funds to support the Simon Estes Foundation's Eliminate Malaria campaign. All proceeds from this concert will be used to buy bed nets for children in Africa. The Foundation's Eliminate Malaria campaign's mission is to save 1 million children. The deaths of these children from malaria is preventable by providing them with an insecticide-treated bed net to sleep under. The net costs $5, and another $5 provides distribution and education. Maestro Junta shares how he became involved in this very worthy project.
Last July 3rd, when we performed a Yankee Doodle Pops, Simon had called me a week or so before that and asked to meet with me and told me about his idea about trying to raise some money for mosquito nets that are necessary and needed in parts of Africa that where these infants are dying, way too many per hour are dying because they get bit by mosquitoes, and this is a bad thing, regardless of where it is in the world. So for $5, all these kids need is a net that they can pull over them at night, and the mosquitoes, by the way, the killing mosquitoes only come out at night. And it seems so silly that this wouldn't be happening. So Simon has kind of taken it on himself to raise a bunch of money to help this cause. And I really am excited about working with him again because it'll be the first time that he gets to meet our academy students. I have about 70 members of the Des Moines Youth Symphony, our top orchestra with the academy, that'll be performing on this concert. We'll be doing Climb Every Mountain and You'll Never Walk Alone with Simon, and then there's a 1,200 voice choir, high school choir, from, I believe, from all 99 counties in the state of Iowa that will join Simon and the orchestra and myself in Ames to perform the Hallelujah Chorus and some other things that I know Dr. James Rohde from Iowa State University is preparing with them. So in total, it's going to be a wonderful afternoon of music. All proceeds go to a good cause, and I'm excited particularly about getting some of our Academy kids connected to Simon Estes. He's got a wonderful story about his life and what he's been through, both professionally and personally, and it's a story that I think everyone should know, especially young people that are looking, trying to find their way in life and trying to find maybe things that they want to do or should do and how to make good decisions. And Simon is no better role model to speak about adversity and how good hard work and surrounding yourself with good people has helped him become, you know, one of the great international opera stars of all time. So I'm thrilled to work with him again and delighted to participate in this project.
And Simon has really taken a challenge to help children around the world, and particularly children from Africa, too.
He has, yes. And he has a school there, you know, in South Africa, and he's just a wonderful humanitarian and you know, obviously great musician, but I've worked with him many, many times since 1989, and he's become not only a musician that I respect and admire, but a tremendous personality, tremendous friend and philanthropist, and this project will be successful. Whatever Simon touches is successful. It's for a great cause. I know that lots of people will be interested and will help with this.
Just getting that many students together and for such a wonderful cause, I think is going to be a marvelous afternoon.
Yeah. We're excited about it. And it's December 15th. And there's also more than just music. There's some film that they're going to show. And, of course, Simon's going to speak. And I know there's some other speakers. But it's primarily going to be music and all for a great cause.
Music director and conductor of the Des Moines Symphony and the Des Moines Symphony Youth Orchestra, Maestro Joseph Junta. The Simon Estes Foundation's Iowa Students Care Christmas Concert will be held at 3 p.m. on December 15th at ISU's Hilton Coliseum. It will feature Iowa's internationally renowned opera singer, humanitarian, educator, and philanthropist Simon Estes, and more than 1,200 singers and instrumentalists from all across Iowa's 99 counties. For more information, please go to the SimonEstesFoundation.org website and click under the Current Events heading. There are so many wonderful holiday concerts occurring this month. We encourage you to attend as many programs in your community and around the state as you can. If you need some help finding concerts, Iowa Public Radio has an events link on our website. We will also be presenting a host of holiday concerts from around Iowa and across the globe. You can find the rundown by going to our website at iowapublicradio.org and clicking on our 2013 holiday schedule icon. Just ahead, January opera opportunities abound in Iowa. You're listening to the Iowa Arts Showcase on Iowa Public Radio.
I'm really looking at this recital as a bit of a homecoming and a family reunion, because that's how I see Des Moines Metro Opera. It's a real artistic family to me in a very literal sense. And when I go back there and sing with them, it's like going back home and singing for my family. It's the, you know, I recognize all these familiar faces. I was there for, you know, 3 years in a row, and I've made some of the most intimate and wonderful connections with people I could ever imagine.
The Des Moines Metro Opera Des Moines Guild Chapter's guest baritone, Michael Mays. You're listening to the Iowa Arts Showcase on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jacqueline Hoblum. Next month, on Saturday afternoon, January 4th at 2, Michael will be returning to Iowa to present a special Des Moines Metro Opera benefit concert at the Cathedral Church of St. Paul in Des Moines with ISU's collaborative pianist Jody Goebel. Michael shares how he got hooked on opera.
I was always exposed to music in school, but my formative experiences began in a little church called New Bethlehem Baptist Church out in Cut and Shoot. Instead of having just a regular sort of piano and organ music program, they always had guitars and banjos and mandolins and fiddles and everything, so it was sort of like having a bluegrass band as our church orchestra. It was really fantastic, you know, at a very early age to start learning how to play instruments and play music. A lot of great things that stuck with me even through today, because I still play country music. And really, you know, it's one of the things I really miss. It's one of the great things about doing things like recitals as an opera singer. You're up there on the stage and you're 30 feet away from the first person, and you know, you can't see what they're doing, you can't see how they're reacting, and you really shouldn't, because you're supposed to be a character. But when you're able to do these kind of small intimate settings, you can really get that energy from the people there in the audience and see how it's affecting them moment to moment. And that's just a completely different experience. And one of the things I miss about, you know, just performing all the time as opposed to rehearsing for a month and, you know, performing for a couple of weeks, you know.
Now, you are also a football star, and actually football...
I wouldn't call myself a star. I played football, but...
But football kind of led you into opera in a backhanded way. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, backhanded literally. I mean, I was a linebacker, and my team, our defense was set up to where linebackers were kind of like mercenaries. You know, we just kind of popped anything that came through the hole. And I was taking my key on a pulling guard, and he pulled around the end of the line, and I did too. And I tried to get around him and ended up getting my fingers hung in his face mask and broke some fingers on my hand. When I walked into my typing class the next day with my hand all bandaged up, she literally looked at me and said, "Go to the counselor's office," because there's no way I could type in typing class and with this big club on my hand. So I walked into the counselor and she looked at me and said, "Well, there's only two things you can join in the middle of a semester. One of those things is choir and the other is drama." Well, I, you know, being where I was at that time in my life, I was like, "I don't want to be around those drama kids. They're weird." Which is ironic, because I became a drama weirdo later in life, right? I mean, but I figured I knew how to sing, because I grew up singing in church and sort of learned how to read music and everything, so that'd be easy A for me. Well, next thing I knew, I'd made All-State Choir and had gotten scholarship offers to go to college in order to, you know, study music. And I figured I would go and, you know, sing in the little choirs and whatever they wanted me to do, take the money and run and get a business degree or something. And next thing I knew, I was doing it for a living.
And we're glad you are. A fantastic story. And also, you got hooked on opera. You were saying that you didn't really even know about opera until you went to college.
Yeah, I didn't even know what it was. It just wasn't a thing that we did in Cut and Shoot. But when I got to college and realized, you know, I've always been sort of a big personality, and I enjoyed acting and sort of being out there and telling stories and things. And when I realized that, you know, singing opera wasn't just sitting up there in a tuxedo doing concerts, it was actually developing these characters and seeing how they affect others on stage. And then on top of that, you're able to sing in this way that can fill up a huge concert hall with no amplification. To me, that was like, hey, that's like the NFL of singing. So I figured if I want to sing, I want to do that. So.
Well, speaking of the NFL of singing, since then you have gone on to sing at some amazing opera companies across the United States. Just give us the Reader's Digest version.
Well, I've sung at Opera Company Philadelphia. Fort Worth Opera is one of my favorite places to work. And, of course, Des Moines Metro Opera. I consider those two companies kind of my home, my artistic home, where I've sort of been able to really develop my talent. And they give me opportunities to do things that, you know, I might not otherwise have been able to do. I've also worked at Michigan Opera Theater. Just, you know, pretty much all the major cities across the country. You just sort of cobble together a year and just pack your bags and run. I've been really fortunate to be able to be involved in a lot of new works and new operas and things. And for me, that's really, you know, once I was able to understand what this art form was, being able to do those new works and those important things that are happening now and the music that's being made now and stories that are relevant to people today and stories and music that can reach people that you wouldn't normally see in an opera house, that's really become a passion of mine.
I also read that you're making your season debut this year at the Boston Lyric Opera, so congratulations.
Yeah, we're real excited about that. You know, whenever you do Verdi, people always say, you know, you should do this role and kind of step it up a little bit and do this next role. Well, Rigoletto is like one of the crown jewels of the Verdi baritone repertoire, and it's going to be my first true dip into the Verdi pool, as it were. People sort of always get you to, you know, they want you to do this small Verdi role and this small Verdi role and sort of dip your pinky toe in and sort of just see how it feels. And then, but that's just not my style. And so I decided to do a cannonball into the deep end with one of the crown jewels of the Verdi repertoire in a great company like Boston Lyric. It's going to be an exciting project for everybody involved.
And you're also developing a name for yourself as a Barry Hunk. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, I don't know if I developed that or not. It just sort of happened, you know. The Barry Hunks website came up, and people have their opinions about that thing, but I'll tell you what, the guys that run it, and it's always come from a really positive place. It's never catty or mean. These guys are just really, you know, loyal opera fans, and they're really excited about the art form. When I first did Dead Man Walking, previous to that experience, I'd been at Des Moines, and that summer I was doing The Count, Nozze di Figaro, and that summer I met a lot of good friends, we had a lot of good times, and I ate a lot of good food, and ate a lot of corn, and I sort of got fattened up like an Iowa cow, you know, and I was about 60 pounds overweight. And up on the horizon, I had this Dead Man Walking coming, and it's a role that's kind of known for having to take your clothes off, and the character you're playing is real muscular, and you got to do 30 push-ups in the middle of one aria, you know, you got to be in shape. So that August, I sort of kicked my tail into gear and dropped about 60 pounds before I had to do that in the winter. That story kind of caught on and became a popular post. They called it From Bear a Chunk to Bear a Hunk. And it was sort of just an interesting story, seeing a guy, you know, lose weight and sort of approach going into an opera role like you approach, like actors going to prepare for, you know, a role in a movie or something like that. You know, you have to be able to have the physical attributes to be able to tell this story. You don't want to make the audience work too hard, you know.
Tell us about this marvelous recital that you're going to be presenting, and not only do you have some traditional favorites, but you had been talking about some new works, and you have those as well. Tell us a little bit about the pieces you're performing.
Well, you know, I'm doing some selections from Rigoletto and from the prologue from Pagliacci. These are things, you know, people that are opera fans would know about, you know. People can kind of label me as a new opera evangelist because I'm always out there really pushing that particular part of our art form. But I chose these pieces not because I think people need to know about this, you know. I chose them because I just think they're really great pieces and people will really enjoy them, and I think they can affect them in a way that they may not be prepared for. And so one of the pieces is Glory Denied, which is the story of Floyd James Thompson. The show is a really emotionally transcendent piece that really affects people, especially people of the Greatest Generation. They can sort of see this, and the people that were, you know, in Korean and Vietnam conflicts, they can see all the shades of that particular time in our cultural development and everything else. And to watch this guy sort of caught up right in the middle of this hurricane of cultural change and sort of get absolutely battered by all the forces involved. It actually inspired some really incredibly moving music. I really wanted people to be exposed to that because I think it's really a touching piece. And of course, the other is an aria from Dead Man Walking, which has come to be one of my signature roles. Jake Heggie, the composer, has done a lot for me in that respect. He's helped me given me the title, you know, the definitive Joseph Durocher, and it carries a lot of weight, and it allows you to do it over and over again and be able to really develop this guy in a way that's you don't always get to do with some of these characters. You only do once or twice, you know.
You're going to be doing, during the second part, a Heggie set as well as a soliloquy. What will those involve?
The Heggie set, Jake and I are talking, and we're sort of putting together some things, so we're going to get together and sort of see what we can put together for the recital, and it's a surprise, so I'll be as surprised as everybody else will be. And the soliloquy is from Carousel, which is a great piece of American Broadway theater.
The Des Moines Metro Opera, Des Moines Guild Chapter's guest baritone, Michael Mays. For more details about the Des Moines Metro Opera and Michael Mays' January 4th benefit recital at the Cathedral Church of St. Paul in Des Moines with pianist Jody Goebel, please go to the education link at the Des Moines Metro Opera.org homepage and click on the DMMO Guild Events link. Just ahead, Carmen and Castanets. You're listening to the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio.
I think about the opening of the second act, that wonderful tavern scene where the dancers are dancing on the tables, and it's, I don't want to say rough, but it's, you know, people drinking and having a good time and very earthy. But at the same time, it still has a French elegance. And I guess that's why we're still listening to this piece. Some of those unmistakable, undefinable things that make the story compelling, and the music, it just paints and portrays the story so beautifully, so intimately.
The Cedar Rapids Opera Theater's executive director and conductor, Dr. Daniel Kleinknecht. On January 17th and 19th, the Cedar Rapids Opera Theater will be presenting Bizet's Fiery Carmen at the Paramount Theater in Cedar Rapids. Daniel talks about their upcoming productions.
Who was this Spanish woman who works in a cigarette factory and sings great songs, these wonderful arias that people know?
Well, that's part of it. I think that there's a lot of wonderful melodies and stuff in this that people do know, but they don't really know that that's what it's from. So mention a few of the things that people will be hearing that perhaps they don't know actually started in Carmen.
Well, you know, the Habanera is probably the most recognizable of the pieces, and it's something that, you know, has made its way into pop culture, I would say. And it is a beautifully written aria for the mezzo and for the chorus. And actually, as I think about that piece, I think about what inspired Bizet. And when I look at the chorus writing, as it responds to Carmen as she's singing, it sort of hovers in a suspended way that's almost like the smoke in the factory, sort of lingering and hovering. And as I look at the piece, I find, wow, this is really a very, very well-written piece. It's so interesting. You know, we hear it and we think, oh yeah, this is the familiar song, but really when you look at it, what the composer did, it's really rather extraordinary, some of the subtlety of composition.
Tell us about the history of the piece, because he took this piece, and when it first opened in Paris, it really wasn't that great of a hit.
A couple of important things, I think, about the structure and maybe the history of the piece. And in fact, this is going to be a different production than that we did early in 2005. The original production was done with dialogue. So we would have music and then dialogue to propel the story forth, and then an aria or a duet, and then dialogue. Later, after the premiere in 1875, it was restructured as recitative. So those dialogues that were in the original became musical, and they were composed as musical recitative, sort of a continuation of that 19th century structure of recitative and aria. And that's going to be different. When we did originally, we did dialogue. Now we'll do the recitative.
Now, you had mentioned that there's a lot of extra things going on and many, many extra singers on stage. Tell us about who all is involved with this.
Well, you're right. It's another huge cast, and I think that's one of the things that makes this really exciting. So we're going to have about 125 people on stage for the big chorus scenes. I'll start with the children's chorus. We have about 30 children. They will come from the Discovery Children's Chorus here in Cedar Rapids, and they will come from the Crescendo Children's Chorus in Iowa City. And then we'll have an adult chorus of people from Iowa City, Cedar Rapids, and the surrounding areas. And we'll have some college and university students. And then we will have 20 young artists from all around the Midwest, basically, and they will supplement the adult chorus. And then we have a couple of supernumeraries in the fourth act. So right now I'm looking for 12 picadors, bullfighters, and we're approaching the Washington High School golf team to see if they would be willing to don a costume and become bullfighters for the production. So it is a big, splendid splash of color and energy that's going to be on the stage at the Paramount. And we've got another great set designer, Rob Sunderman, from Iowa State University. He designed the Bohème set, and it's going to be really quite wonderful. It has a bridge that goes across, you know, up above the people. And stage directors always like for there to be different elevations so they can put people up high, down low, stage left, stage right. So I think when our stage director comes and actually sees the set, Bill Ferrara is our stage director, he's going to be thrilled with what Rob has designed and what we've built.
Tell us about Bill being here, and you've worked with him before.
I worked for a company called the Peoria Civic Opera. It became later Opera Illinois. Unfortunately, it has since closed, but that's really where I learned how to conduct opera, how to form and start an opera company. And that's where I met Bill. Bill was one of the stage directors that the conductor there, Fiora Contino, brought in. And we made a friendship then. And Bill is a wonderful mind. He has a wonderful vision. He really brings out the truth in the performances of the singers. And I like that. I really like working with him. He's got great ideas, great execution. And in fact, he has Iowa connections. He was the stage director at the University of Northern Iowa. And he definitely knows Iowa, and he knows Cedar Rapids Opera Theater.
And Iowa winters. Tell us about the folks that are going to be singing the major lead roles.
Mm-hmm. Genera Kellerman is a splendid Carmen. She sang this role in Des Moines several years ago. And Genera is just a wonderful singer and actress. And, you know, she looks so beautiful. She has beautiful dark hair, big, beautiful eyes. And she really looks like Carmen and sounds like her. She's going to be splendid. We can't wait to have her here.
She has Iowa roots?
She does. Yes. She went to high school here. And she sang for us the first time was in a production of La Traviata. And then she sang a production of Butterfly. And in the ill-fated summer of the flood, she was the Amneris in Aida. So she has been with us before, and we are welcoming her with open arms as our Carmen. The Don Jose is a man named Alok Kumar. And Alok is a New York City singer as well as Genera. And he is a wonderful singer. So we're really looking forward to having him, as well as Phil Torre, who is our Escamillo. Phil was here last year as our Marcello. And Philip was so strong. He's one of the greatest singers I've ever worked with. I just love his sound, and I think he's going to be a terrific Escamillo.
Carmen has quite a bit of dancing and other kinds of things in it. So tell us how that's all going to happen. And of course, Genera has to be very seductive.
She does. And she also has to play the castanets. She has her own castanets, which is really handy. She has to dance. She has to be alluring. And Genera is all of these things in addition to being just a wonderful, beautiful, again, I'll say hall-filling. She has, her voice is wonderfully hall-filling. It's one of those voluptuous sounds that you want to hear and see. She'll bring all of that into her performance of Carmen, I believe.
Daniel Kleinknecht, music director and conductor of the Cedar Rapids Opera Theater, talking about their upcoming January 17th and 19th presentations of Bizet's Carmen. The Cedar Rapids Opera Theater will also be presenting their Young Artists in January productions of The Billy Goat's Gruff, along with an adult forum, a pre-concert brunch, and curtain talks prior to each performance. For more details, please see their website at cr-opera.org. Today's Iowa Art Showcase broadcast is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Program thanks for this show goes to Michael Eagle, John Cook, Ron Gilbert, Joseph Junta, Michael Mays, and Daniel Kleinknecht. Program assistance was also received from Dennis Hendrickson, Sarah Compton, Paul Ferrone, and Virginia McCollajack. Production thanks goes to Iowa Public Radio's Tony Daner. Thanks for this show also goes to Iowa Public Radio's music director Al Scherz, along with IPR's Eric Jordan, Jason Burns, Garrett Van Leeuwen, and Cooper Holmeyer. Program research was provided by IPR's Nick Carlo and Mallory Sullivan. I'm Jacqueline Hallbloom. Happy holidays. For more information on Iowa Public Radio's programming schedule and Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase, please visit our website at iowapublicradio.org.